So as the lawyers for the second case are changing places with the lawyers for the third case, please take your time. You might have noticed, if you didn't know it before walking into the courtroom, we're a little off schedule today. We had a brief evacuation. But we do have four matters on our oral argument calendar. We're ready for the third one, even though we're a little bit off schedule. So just take your time, both lawyers, and settle in when you're ready. Actually, I think for the third matter, we have two lawyers for the appellant, right? Two separate briefs. I think I was informed that you've already reached a decision on how to allocate the argument time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good.
I informed the marshal after the brief recess.
Okay, very good. Thank you. All right, well, the lawyers are continuing to get settled at the council table. I ask the marshal to call the third case.
Now calling cases A23-1103 in the matter of the welfare of the children of RVM and JRM, as well as A23-1125.
All right, and I can see that the lawyers have settled in. I'll make just a few quick remarks, and then the council for appellant can proceed as you've already indicated. You've divided the argument and whoever is going first. I'll just remind all the lawyers of things that you probably already know, which is that when you get to the podium, it is adjustable and you can take your time to settle in and get yourself organized before you begin your remarks. When you do start your remarks, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. And then in case you missed my announcement earlier, please know that Judge Smith is present and in the courtroom. She is participating remotely, and so you may hear her ask a question during the course of the argument, but please know that she is here and present. So with that, I think we are ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, whichever one of you has decided to go first, can go first. And I think the clock is already set at 10 minutes. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent appellant RVM, the mother of the two children involved in this termination proceeding. Several decades ago, in this court's opinion in MDO, Judge Klaphockey, in dissent, noted that he believed that the case involved a rush to judgment. And I think we have exactly that same problem here today in dealing with the parents of the two minor children, MDO. There is no dispute here that this case presents extremely difficult facts. That's not the question for this court, however. The issue for this court instead is, did the county meet its burden of proof in and did the district court make sufficient findings and reach appropriate conclusions given the evidence that was in the record? This court has a very important function to undertake here, and that is that it is obligated to first to examine whether the evidence reaches the level of clear and convincing, which is the burden of proof, of course, in termination cases. But in doing so, this court undertakes a close inquiry into the record, and it examines that record as a whole. It doesn't focus on individual pieces of the evidence, but it looks at the record as a whole in determining whether the county met its ultimate burden of clear and convincing evidence, which is evidence that is highly probable to establish a particular fact. So let's look at the couple of major issues in this case. First, I'd like to address the absence of services and the absence of a case plan in this case, which I think is ultimately dispositive. Then look at the primary issue in the case, which is the allegations regarding son's condition and his medical situation. And then thirdly, the best interest of the child. And hopefully I can get through all of that in 10 minutes. I probably won't, but co-counsel can pick up where I left off, or counsel for father can pick up where I left off. The record is undisputed here that there were very, very few services. In fact, there's only one service offered. That service was supervised visitation with a supervisor whom even the district court described as too picky. The absence of services here is highly significant, even given the relatively rapid effort or rapid processing of this case. Again, the rush to judgment existed in this case. First, there were three district court orders to provide services, including one where the county went in and specifically asked, can we be excused from providing services? And the district court said no. The response of the county was to wait weeks before they had a single contact with mother, and that was to establish the visitation. Nothing further. That in a record which is demonstrative that these were parents who required or could benefit from services. That was undisputed. The social worker said, yes, these parents would benefit from services. The guardian ad litem said these parents would benefit for services, and in fact went so far as to testify that this was the first case in which she felt conflicted about whether or not termination was appropriate and that the trial had only increased her level of concern or her level of conflict and the indecision she was able to make about giving an opinion of whether termination was appropriate.
Counsel, I agree that in reviewing this file, the services issue is a serious one. But it appears to me, again, in the detail that was provided here, that the reason, I'm presuming what the county is going to say, is that the safety, as they put it, was paramount, and the concern for the health of these children, and the feeling that, I almost get the feeling when you read this whole thing that they'd fallen behind a little bit and they realized it was out of control and these kids were in desperate need. And based on that, they moved very, very quickly. And as you say, did not engage services other than supervised visitation. Your comment on that?
Sure, Your Honor. The children were safe. Unless the foster parents were engaging in inappropriate conduct, the children were removed from the home.
I'm talking about the TPR now. I'm just saying that in terms of having those kids go back to those parents.
Well, Your Honor, there are a lot of steps that could have been taken, agreed, short of TPR to protect these children.
Well, during the CHIPS proceeding, I understand.
Yes. And if the TPR had been denied, the county was asked, the social worker was asked that question. What would you do if the district court judge says, no, I'm not allowing the termination at this stage of events? The social worker went through a laundry list of services that would have been provided to these parents immediately, all of which, by everything in the record, the evidence would have suggested could have been or would have been corrected. This testimony in this case was undisputed, was undisputed that there was only one reason that the termination even went that far, and that was son's injuries. There was no case plan developed, which, and again, the lack of services and the lack of a case plan are dispositive under this court's law. Under the jurisprudence of this court, that mandates a reversal. And it is not a post-trial decision for the district court to make. It is to be made prior to trial. That was not done here. And on that basis alone, the case should be reversed and remanded. But even if we ignore that issue, let me address, Judge Cleary, the question that is implicit in your question, which is the harm to the son. And that's the driving force here. In fact, both the guardian and the social worker testify that absent the skull fractures, there never would have been a termination of parental rights petition even brought. So what do we...
Before you do that, and I do want to hear what you have to say on that, there is case law that would suggest that the lack of a case plan is not dispositive in termination cases if the circumstances render the lack of case plan excusable.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the problem here is that there is no excuse.
Okay.
The excuse that the county offers is there's a risk to the children. Well, there's no risk to the children. They've been removed from the house. So they're not under the parents' care any longer. They're not in the environment that led them to what is alleged to have been a risky situation. So the absence of a case plan is unexcused on this record. And the district court judge makes mention of the case plan not being developed while there's an ongoing investigation. Well, there's two problems with that. One is the kids are removed, so the ongoing investigation doesn't impact anything going on between the parents and the county at that point. And second of all, according to the investigating officer, he left the Mankato Police Department and joined the Blue Earth County Sheriff's Department, and everything stopped. There was no further investigation into what had occurred and who had done or who had caused the injuries to Sun. And so the county, and so even that excuse falls flat when the the district court relied on. But let me very briefly address the fractures, because I've only got 1 minute and 15 seconds left.
Council, I just want to ask you, in light of the time, you keep, and it's important to do so, refer to Son's injuries and the skull fractures. They're important in this case. But it's that mother and father testified they were unaware of the injuries to
yes.
the child. So would you address that? Because that seems to also have been a crucial factor in the way the county handled the case.
Well, Your Honor, no one was aware of the skull fractures.
Correct.
Mother and father were unaware. There were multiple medical professionals who saw Son during the time period the expert testified based on the age of the guesstimated age of the fractures. There were police officers who saw the child. There was the babysitter, child care provider who saw the child. All of them had physical contact with the child. Medical professionals, none of them found any evidence of skull fractures. It was only after the child was brought in and the whole body scan was done, and then the fractures were discovered. And that's consistent with the expert's testimony.
There are other fractures that were noted, right?
There are other fractures. Okay. There are three sets.
But not by the parents.
Not by the parents, but not by anybody else either.
Well,
and again, we're holding.
But the bruising, counsel. I mean, I guess we can parse this out fact by fact, but I don't think that will get to the point of your argument, which has to be, as you said, focused on the district court's findings of fact and the county's burden of proof. So putting it, and maybe you'll want to do this later in your rebuttal, I'm not trying to guide your argument, but it's crucial to put the totality of the evidence, I think, in perspective. And that's what I'm asking you to do, because it seems to me the county's concern is that both of these parents, and you're talking about the mother, were unaware of the significant and serious injuries and harm that had been done to this child.
And, Your Honor, I'll leave it to you whether you want me to answer that question now or wait till rebuttal.
I mean, if you're ready to answer.
I'm perfectly fine answering it now, Your Honor. Yes. The record is undisputed that there are three sets of fractures, if you will, the femur fracture, a couple of rib fractures, and then the skull fractures. The record is also undisputed about the timing of when each of those fractures occurred or would have been in existence, the leg fracture perhaps from birth up to the time that the x-ray was taken, and then the rib and skull fractures various times prior to February 24th, depending on which fracture you're talking about. There was no dispute about when those occurred. The totality of the evidence here, which this court has to consider, is yes, the parents were unaware, other than father talking about having seen his son react a couple of days when changing diapers when the leg fracture was apparently in existence. Other than that, the parents were unaware. These children were seen by multiple medical professionals. In every one of the medical records, there is a reference to the full body examination that doctors undertake every time an infant walks in the door. And every one of those doctors found nothing wrong that would have triggered a response to a fracture. The others who had interaction with this child testified that they did not have any evidence of a fracture. Even the grandmother, who testified about having noticed some issues with the child and talked to her son about it, only recognized the child was becoming fussier. Children get fussier for a whole lot of reasons.
Counsel, I have to interrupt you because I'm looking at a finding that says the facial bruising and fractures, facial bruising too, and that's apparent, occurred while the parents' relationship was intact, while the injured child resided with both parents, and while parents were the injured child's primary caretakers. So it isn't just the fractures. There's signs that would ask you to look deeper.
And what did the expert tell us about how a parent should respond to those? The pediatrician said, if the parent believes they have a reasonable explanation for a bruise, and the child is not exhibiting symptoms as a result of the bruise, the pediatrician would not expect them to come to the doctor. So again, what we're doing is we're holding these parents to a standard which nobody else is expected to meet. Not the physicians, not the police officers who interacted with his family twice. Nobody else is expected to reach that standard, and I don't think that's appropriate, and the case law does not support holding the parents to that level of a standard. So if you look at the record, the totality of the record as a whole, the experts all testified that infants can have fractures and exhibit no symptoms. That is not an unreasonable or impossible scenario. In fact, it's likely. And that infants are extremely difficult to diagnose for fractures because they can't tell you what hurts. And so you are left with a process of elimination, if you will, that this isn't working. So let's try something different. And that's demonstrated perhaps most explicitly in this record, where son is brought into the doctor on February 23rd for abdominal distress. It's diagnosed as an ear infection and vomiting as a result, and the son is given antibiotics and an anti-nausea medication. That doesn't work. What does mom do? Mom takes him to the hospital, which is where the gastrointestinal issue, and I cannot pronounce that word, so I'm not even going to try, that gastrointestinal issue is diagnosed. So even doctors got it wrong with this child the first time with a significant medical condition. And the record is undisputed here that the same thing happens with fractures. And on that basis, the district court erred in finding clear and convincing evidence, even with the bruising and the various fractures and the other symptoms that son exhibited, in finding that there was clear and convincing evidence to support termination.
Thank you, counsel. So we'll reset the clock to give counsel for father 5 minutes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Winkler, and I am attorney for the father in this matter, J.R.M. Mr. White has eloquently outlined many of the arguments that were included in both of our briefs. We divided the time as we did today because a father necessarily, I would say, taking a lesser role in providing care, particularly for an infant child, and not being directly involved in several of the factual issues that the court relied on in reaching its conclusions. One place where I can pick this matter up, though, is in regards to the last question and the facial bruising that was noted by the court, and it was father's testimony specifically, not a trained professional, but that did correspond almost exactly with what the pediatrician had said in this matter, that if the bruising also included a change of behavior or indications that the child was not otherwise feeling okay, that would warrant an additional trip to the hospital. He had testified that the infant was its typical laughing, giggly self, and that because he had a good explanation for those bruises, particularly that the older sister might have bitten him, that it wasn't warranted. The court has found that post-trial findings that reasonable efforts are futile are insufficient when there has been pre-trial determinations that reunification efforts must be made. And this seems particularly appropriate given the ease for a court to arrive at post hoc justifications for a lack of a case plan after it terminates. In this case, the reasons outlined by the court that there was an ongoing investigation, even though, as again, Mr. Whitehead indicated, all indications were that that investigation had ended in April, and that
the investigation ended without a resolution. Isn't that correct? In terms of the county was not able to ascertain who caused any of the injuries.
That's correct. And that brings up another interesting point here, which was that the county had until January 30th of 2024 to file a termination in this matter. If the investigation had stalled out, or certainly if there hadn't been any conclusions reached about the most pressing and important factor in this matter, who or what caused the injuries to the infant's son, why the rush to immediately file a TPR in this matter when the children at that point are in foster care and there's no risk for additional injury to them? If this is an unknown at this point, or there's more that could be done to make a determination, why the rush to file the TPR? And you combine that with the lack of a case plan, or I suppose even if there had been a case plan, but insufficient time for parents to develop the parenting skills that the county had indicated were necessary for these parents, then there's two prongs that are directed towards that same issue. And again, what was the necessity for the rush to judgment in this matter? And what did it cost the parents who did not have the opportunity and were not provided any guidance by the county to develop any parenting skills or the parenting skills that were deemed necessary here? But more to the point, what the guardian ad litem had indicated rings true here, I think most resoundingly, which is that if it were not for the skull fractures, this was not an issue where other parental issues would have been sufficient to induce a termination in this case. The court does note that single...
I'm sorry to interrupt in this disembodied way. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to me about why that matters when, in fact, there were skull fractures? I read that in a briefing. I wasn't really sure what the point of that argument was. I mean, the child had skull fractures.
I think it is to the point that in its order, the court notes issues regarding, for instance, hygiene or education as additional reasons or conclusions that are facts that lead to the court's conclusion regarding termination. But when the guardian ad litem and the social worker indicate that in their mind, at least, those were not reasons to terminate, that's the purpose of that argument. It's not negating the seriousness of the skull fracture. Clearly, it's the overriding fact in the court's mind, appropriately here. However, those other issues that the court does cite are frankly trivial and don't rise to what the guardian ad litem and social worker indicated would be necessary to terminate otherwise. And with that, I see my time is out, so I appreciate the court's attention in this matter today.
Just one moment, counsel. Either of the judges have another question? No. Thank you very much, counsel. And of course, appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll reset the clock for respondent. Oh, it's already there. So counsel for respondent, we're ready for you. When you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Susan DeVos. I'm an assistant Blue Earth County attorney. I'm here today on behalf of the Blue Earth of Blue Earth County, and I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision terminating appellant's parental rights to the children in this case, CM and AM. At bottom, this case is an egregious harm case, and a case about egregious harm to a five-month-old child. That makes this case a different case, a case that is, in fact, by statute, required to be a rush to judgment. So I don't disagree with counsel's description of that in this case. And that is because that's the way the legislature and this court has directed egregious harm cases are supposed to take place. In fact, egregious harm petitions are supposed to be filed within 30 days of the egregious harm being discovered. That was nearly done in this case. It was slightly outside of that. There was some additional investigation that took a little additional time, and then that was filed. Egregious harm cases are also the carve-out in which reasonable efforts by statute are generally not required.
Counsel, may I ask you about that? Of course, we know that that determination was not made, to relieve the county of efforts. And the statute provides for being relieved of those efforts if the parent has subjected to a child to egregious harm. Even at the end of this, I think the district court found that the parents had, in fact, inflicted egregious harm, but that they should have known about the harm. So I'm wondering why that has relevance to what appears to be, of course, only one service that I think has been identified, which is supervised parenting. Even if we were to reverse and remand because we found that the efforts were not made, reasonable efforts were not made, there wouldn't necessarily be an exception to efforts under the statute given the court's findings.
If I'm understanding your question correctly, I agree with you, Your Honor. If this case were to go back, to look at whether or not a case plan should be drafted, the district court already found that there's egregious harm that was known or should have been known by the parents. So the statute would have allowed the court to have relieved the county of making the requirement of making reasonable efforts if it made there was a prima facie determination of egregious harm.
Well, when I'm looking at the statute right now, it says stating a prima facie case that the parent has subjected a child to egregious harm. I don't see that to have been found here in this case.
Okay, I see what you mean. Is it tailored to just if the parent themselves caused it?
Correct.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that is how the statute has been interpreted, and I will point the court to 260C.001. Subdivision 3, this talks about the purpose of the statute, and it does say that it's talking about making reasonable efforts towards reunification, and it says specifically, nothing in this section requires reasonable efforts to prevent placement or to reunify the child with the parent to be made in circumstances where the court has determined that the child has been subjected to egregious harm. So the focus is on the child, and in this case, as the Supreme Court and this court has looked at, that it is not required that the parents are the ones that caused the egregious harm, but that they knew or should have known that that egregious harm happened and that it happened while the child was in their care. In this case, it does not appear that there is any dispute that this child, CM, with a five-month-old infant, suffered egregious harm in the sense that he suffered multiple rib fractures, the femur fracture, multiple skull fractures, the brain bleed, all of which occurred before this child was age 5 months. I don't think there's any dispute about that. So we get to whether the parents knew or should have known in this case. Although appellants focus on the fact that there are different interpretations of the facts, that is not what this court does here. The court looks at whether the facts that have been determined by the district court can be upheld. And there is clear and convincing evidence here that supports the decision of and the findings of the district court. There is evidence in the record that at least the grandmother, the father's mother, indicated that she knew through her son, CM's father, that CM was fussy and having some concerns about his what appeared to be his leg. There is discussion in, or is there is testimony, significant testimony about the bruising on the face. That bruising on the face was noted by the only non-relative caretaker that took care of the child that we are aware of, and that was noticed immediately. In fact, she called the police. So that wasn't something that shouldn't have been noticed by a parent. There was a number of points made by appellants that we're holding the parents to a different standard. That's absolutely true. That's what the statute requires. These are the parents. They are the caregivers of this child, not somebody who sees them in passing, not someone who has a quick visit in the urgent care in which the provider is relying primarily on what the parent is telling them about the child's symptoms. These are parents who are the primary caregivers for this child, and they didn't notice, or they told the court that they didn't notice. That was their argument. Yet some of their testimony was a bit confusing. There was some testimony from the father in this case that talked about he did notice some fussiness with the child with regard to his leg. He was confused about the timing. But that's in there. That's in the record. There's evidence in the record that the timing around the time that the potential femur fracture and rib fractures may have occurred is when there was a missed well child visit. Those are all things that the district court looked at and considered in this case in making the determination that these parents knew or should have known of these multiple injuries. Much has been made about the fact that this wouldn't have been a termination case if it weren't for the skull fractures. True, this wouldn't have been a termination case if it wasn't an egregious harm to this child. We wouldn't have been at termination at the timing we were. Maybe it would have gotten there, but this case came in initially because of harm that was noted by medical providers to this child. That's what precipitated it. As more information was learned that this child not only had some injuries that appeared to be non-accidental, the child had many injuries which appeared to have occurred over a series of months to this child who was only at that time 5 months old, had experienced numerous injuries in the care of those parents.
Counsel, I take it that the status of these children being infants played into the county's position here as to how they approached it.
The ages of the children, Your Honor?
They were infants, right?
Yes.
Highly vulnerable.
Yes.
I take it that's at least part of why the county moved to with the speed that it did.
Yes, Your Honor. The ages of the children make a difference in terms of what the children can tell the county about what happened. Makes a difference about the amount of time that others have had to observe the children and the places that the children go, if these children were in a daycare or if they were in a school age setting, so a bit older, we would have more information that way so we could have looked at that. But in this case, again, because of the statute, the way the statute reads, we are to bring an egregious harm petition for termination of parental rights within that 30-day period, regardless of age, but certainly the age comes into play when we're considering the number of injuries that happened to this child in such a short period of time, as evidenced by those x-rays that were found or that were observed and testified to by numerous medical professionals in this case. So, Your Honors, this case comes down to addressing, there's three things I think that have been at issue here. One is the case plan issue, and as I previously mentioned with regard to the reasonable efforts, given the circumstances in this case in which the court has already determined egregious harm has happened, sending it back for the court, for the district court to order a case plan when the court has already determined there's egregious harm makes little sense if the court could have made a prima facie case and just cut off the requirement of reasonable efforts. So sending it back to do a case plan after the fact just doesn't make sense in this case. In this case, the court has determined, the district court has determined that there's been egregious harm. The newer should have known, Your Honors, there's significant evidence in the record that reflects the fact that these parents, as the primary caregivers of these children, should have known if they didn't know, should have known that the child had suffered these injuries. And then finally, I want to touch on best interests here, that certainly we weigh three things. We weigh the child's interest in the parent-child relationship, the parent's interest in the parent-child relationship. No one doubts the fact that children and parents have an interest in maintaining that bond. And I can't tell you here today that that isn't true. What I can tell you is, as the district court found, the child's interests in this case of safety outweigh that parent-child relationship. That is the point of the 260C statute, is there are some circumstances in which the bonds between parents and children need to be severed to protect the children. That's what was done in this case. That's what was done by this district court, who painstakingly considered the record. I have never seen a district court decision in which the court spent so much time articulating findings in this case. This court really listened. I don't think anyone can say that the district court was not taking in all of the information in this case and articulated it for us. So we know that this district court heard all of the evidence, took it all into consideration in making this decision, and I'm asking this court to affirm it today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So there will be, the clock will be reset 5 minutes for rebuttal. Are counsel splitting that time as well? Or?
We are not. Mr. White will handle the rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin with what I think is a significant factor here, which is the county acknowledging that this is an egregious harm case. That acknowledgement in and of itself alters the analysis here, and I think it becomes paramount for this court then to dig into the case law a little deeper than perhaps my initial argument would have suggested. And I specifically would ask the court to look at JP, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision discussing egregious harm, BTN, and most importantly, APS. And I violated one of those old rules of don't put block quotes in your brief. At pages 54 and 55 of our brief, of Mother's brief, where I quoted extensively from APS. And I did that with a specific purpose in mind because I think it fits this case so beautifully. And yes, it's an unpublished decision from 2011. It's not precedential, but I think it's highly instructive for this court. And it highlights the three things that in an egregious harm case have to be established under JP. First is knowledge or should have known of the injury. Second is the parents have to know of conduct which would reasonably result in that egregious injury, and there's no evidence in this record anywhere of anything that would suggest that these parents were aware of, or anyone else for that matter, of conduct that would have resulted in a fracture. Not the leg fracture, not the rib fractures, and certainly not the skull fractures. There's nothing in this record to support that the parents were aware of the conduct.
Counsel, I understand your argument and the APS case. Something happened to these children. I mean, we're hearing from everybody that nobody knew about it and nobody saw it and everybody's surprised, but something happened to these children.
Well, something happened to one of them. I think it's important to keep
okay.
that distinction.
All right. Something seriously happened to one of them. And is it enough that everybody says, gee, it wasn't me, I don't know?
Well, Your Honor, the case law would suggest that yes, but the issue here is the county has a burden of proof. And the county has a burden of proving that there is some incident, some event which would have led the parents to conclude that egregious harm had had occurred. So, for example, if one of the other caretakers had squeezed child too hard and fractured his ribs, he then comes home to mom and dad and they pick him up and he screams. Now there is something that might lead a parent to start thinking about, is there something in the chest slash abdominal area of my child that should cause me concern?
Agreed.
And
agreed,
that gets you, I think, to what JP is discussing.
Okay, I understand that, but you also agree with the obvious, which is that infants can't speak. I mean, they can't. So you're not going to have the child let you know the problems.
Exactly, and that's part of the problem here, Your Honor, with the whole argument of the county, which is the parents should have known when nobody else knew. And so under the clear and convincing evidence standard and the review of the record in totality, again, we get to what is it here that would have red flagged, if you will, these parents that there was something wrong with their child. Their child has a significant abdominal medical condition that I cannot pronounce. And that is described by the physicians as repeating. It comes and goes. The medical professionals missed it several times when the child was in to see them. All of that points to there being no or insufficient evidence to a clear and convincing evidence standard here that the parents should have known. And there's no conduct here that the parents were aware of that would have resulted in egregious harm, which JP requires, as this court highlighted in APS. And finally, there's no evidence in this record of a disregard for the child's welfare, which is the third thing that JS or JP requires. These parents were exceptionally concerned about the child's welfare. They kept taking him to the doctor. If the parents had information about all of these fractures, the best way to keep that from the world is not to take him to the doctor. The parents didn't do that. They repeatedly took him to the doctor over and over and over again, trying to find an answer for what they couldn't explain. So on that basis, Your Honor, I think the record it does not reach the clear and convincing evidence standard in the record as a whole, and this court should reverse the matter and remand it to the district court, recognizing that, yes, then a case plan will be developed, but the children are in a safe condition while the parents undergo that, working that plan. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to all the lawyers in this case. The matter is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.